Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
I want to welcome you for tonight's program. This is the fifth in a series of talks that are part of the Henrietta Lacks Project and Henrietta Lacks series that we've been running in San Diego. My name is Mike Kalichman. I'm the director for the Center for Ethics in Science and Technology. And I want to welcome you to what should be a fascinating discussion about some key issues that go with the story of Henrietta Lacks. Tonight's program will be moderated by the president of Grossmont College, Sunita Cook, who will come up in a moment and introduce tonight's speaker. During tonight's program, I would like you to keep in mind, especially for those of you who might be new to our program, that the goal of these activities is to engage the public in a way that isn't simply a matter of outreach. We aren't here to simply tell you the answers, so we don't want you to be a passive recipient of information. We are looking for you to also provide feedback to the academic community, to the scientists, to scholars thinking about how best to approach the challenges of science and technology. In doing that, we ask our audience to remember that just because somebody disagrees with you does not mean that they are evil or ignorant, but that they, in fact, might just see things in a different way than you. So we want to not only hear from you, but we want you to listen to others and try and understand what their perspectives are. So at this point, I'm going to introduce President Cook, who, by the way, has a background as a scientist and a biologist, who will serve as this evening's moderator, and she'll introduce tonight's speaker.
So good evening. Thanks for being here. You look like a sharp crowd, so I think we're going to have lots of comments and questions, and the hard ones will go to Tate. So it's good. We'll save them up for you. You know, it's my honor and privilege tonight to introduce you to you someone who I've gotten to know over the last 5 years as a tenured faculty member at Grossmont College. I thought it would be important for you to know just a little bit about his background in education. He received both his master's and his doctorate from UC Riverside in 19th century British literature. His dissertation topic was on rhetoric of science and the formation of subjects in Victorian writing. So I'm sure that's eminently clear to you what that means. And really, I think what's relevant to tonight, I'm going to keep talking a little bit about, he joined Grossmont College in 2006, and the real claim to fame this last year has been Tate has served as our point person for all the activities that have happened on our campus focused on the Henrietta Lacks Project. So we've had a really, truly multidisciplinary approach to offering this book to our students, our faculty, our staff, and encouraging them to have very different dialogues about the kinds of things that would involve science and ethics and culture and history and African-American culture and the kinds of things that they might not otherwise think about, talk about, or debate. And so he's really been the point person not only for what's happened on our campus, but he has served as the point person to the rest of San Diego County, all the universities that have participated in the effort, the Science Museum as well. And so for that, he's become quite a hero on campus. And in fact, I know that several people have asked him to do this every year on campus, to collaborate and make this happen on campus, and he's kind of gulped and said reluctantly that he might consider it after a few years of time off. Two other things that you might want to know about Tate is that he serves on an advisory board called the California Learning Communities Consortium. And that's really a group that's focused on interdisciplinary learning communities. And if you're not familiar with those, they are really groups of students that, in this case, enter college and enter college in a group of courses needing extra support through a team of teachers. They're a cohort. They travel together through these courses. They get support not only for this team of teachers, but from each other as students. And so it's really a nice system for assisting students as they transition into college. And for Tate, he has taught in some of these learning communities that involve coupling English with math or English with science. And so he really lives what he advises and he lives what he practices. And I think you'll be really enlightened by what he has to say today about science literacy. So with that as an introduction, take it away, Tate.
Thank you, Dr. Cook. Thank you, Mike Kalichman of the Center for Ethics. And it really has been fantastic being a part of the Henrietta Lacks Project at Grossmont, and it's exciting for me to be here. I've been to dozens of these Exploring Ethics events. I love them, and so to be up in front talking at one of them is a special treat for me. Let me pull up my slide. This on my computer looks fantastic. On that screen, it looks black. We'll just deal with it. Partway through the immortal life of Henrietta Lacks, Deborah Lacks, Henrietta's daughter, is trying to make sense of Henrietta's legacy, what HeLa cells mean, how they've been used, what's happening with them now, and she, like most of us, consults Google. And what she finds on Google is a range of information. Some of it is scientific report, some of it is conspiracy theory, some of it is just downright silliness, and she has very little capacity to distinguish one from the other. And what this causes for her is an anxiety attack. It's a debilitating anxiety attack that leaves her really sort of unable to move forward in investigating her mother's legacy because she simply is overwhelmed, intimidated, and defeated. It's a very dramatic moment, and a poignant one for me as an educator, but unfortunately not a very uncommon moment, I think, and that there are many, many people who feel this way about the science in our culture today, and who had this sort of experience when they tried to decipher what's happening in science today. So what this talk is going to do is give you some sense of where we are in terms of science literacy in this country, and also in terms of reading literacy generally, and then to give you some sense of what kinds of promising research is going on that shows positive results. And then finally, and I think most importantly for our discussion, to look at why, despite these promising results, we have not yet implemented these things into our curriculum in a systematic way. And my argument will be that there are some genuine, difficult ethical dilemmas at the core of this that we have yet to make and yet to face up to. And I think that's going to be where I'd like to end the talk and maybe open up for discussion. So to start at the beginning, our science knowledge. The National Center for Education Statistics reports that between 1996 and 2005, science achievement scores among U.S. students, and this is 12th grade students, dropped from a score of 150 to 147. This is out of a possible 300. Now, I put 300 on there, and that sounds really depressing, but we don't really know what that number means. So the next statistic, I think, is a bit more telling. In that report, only 20% of U.S. 12th graders tested at or above proficient. 80% of our 12th graders nationwide in this survey are testing below proficient levels in their science. As of the most recent international survey, that puts the U.S. 21st in the world in science literacy. And according to a 2009 survey conducted by the California Academy of Science, 41% of adults believe that humans and dinosaurs lived at the same time, which shows perhaps a very good basic understanding of popular culture, things like the Flintstones and Land of the Lost, but not so much about our science. And I put this statistic in here, and I think it's fun and sad at the same time, but it's also a little bit misleading because it tempts us into thinking that the problem with our science literacy is fundamentally a content problem. And I don't think that it is. I think fundamentally our problem as a nation in relation to science is a literacy problem. That's why this is about science literacy. And let me show you a little bit about how we're doing on literacy, reading literacy, in this same survey. We were scoring an average of 288, 12th graders in this country scoring an average of 288. This is out of a possible 500. This means it's slightly better than our science, but still woefully low. 35% of 12th graders tested at or above proficient. At community colleges statewide, I teach at a community college, somewhere between 65 and 70%, it fluctuates, of students test into what are called basic skills courses. This is below freshman level English composition courses. Grade level reading scores in those courses range from 4th grade to 10th grade level, and 6th to 8th grade is really more average. So we have 65 to 70% of college students at the community college, and that's no small portion of our higher education community. At Grossmont alone, we have over 20,000 students, are testing in with, let's call it a 7th grade reading ability on average. They're faced with college textbooks that are written at the 13th, 14th, 15th, 16th grade level. So they walk into their first day of science class, and they are faced with a textbook that is that requires 6, 7, 8 grade levels above their abilities. And this presents a problem. Not that they can't understand science, that they can't even access the concepts in the textbooks that are given to them. So why does this matter? It's no surprise, right, that for those of us in this room, I think that 21st century requires an unprecedented level of scientific knowledge. And that in an information age with so much information so available or even unavoidable, we have to have higher levels of efficiency as readers as well. It's not just our ability to understand science. It's our ability to move through information effectively, productively, and efficiently that is also at an all-time high. If you are science illiterate in this country, you may not be equipped to face these things, politics of climate change, and we've seen the problem around that in this country. Questions of stem cell research and its applications, and questions of the theory of evolution, genetic manipulation, and to bring it to a more personal level, your own or your own family's health care. Navigating your own health care can be very, very difficult, and that's actually going to be the focus of a talk in a couple of months from now. We are affected every day by our scientific decisions, even if, and maybe some would argue, especially if that decision is not to pay attention to it. So, what do we do about this? Well, there are about 10 to 15 years of research studies that show some very promising potential around scientific literacy work that involves incorporating reading literacy into science content courses, making that a part of the way we teach science so that we are teaching students how to work with the text they receive in the class, how to be more aware of their own learning and reading in science courses. So let me show you a little bit more about the problem. Studies of students revealed that their knowledge about reading science, metacognitive awareness, and I'll come back to that term, was only partially developed, and strategies they used to repair comprehension failures were not well developed, especially with science text. And this is a key issue as well, repairing comprehension failures. Good readers, almost unconsciously, have a whole set of strategies for recognizing when they don't understand something and have the ability to reach into that toolkit and use a variety of strategies to repair that failure of comprehension. This is not a skill people are born with, and it is not a skill, unfortunately, that most people intuit without instruction. In lieu of helping students, this is still part of the problem. This is a research from 2011, last year. In lieu of helping students develop the proficiencies needed to read, write, and reason with the language, texts, and dispositions of science, typical instructional strategies for struggling readers involved simplifying, slowing the pace, and often abandoning more rigorous coursework. And, you know, this is something that science teachers struggle with mightily. Right. As the science teachers are faced with students who enter into a classroom and are not able to handle the content or make sense of the content, they're faced with some tough choices. Do I just move on and leave those students behind? Do I slow down and make sure that every student is you know, figuring it out, or do I make do I cut my losses at 50%? These are tough choices, and how to repair that comprehension problem is difficult. So the solutions, and this is where I'm talking about some of the recent work that's being done, have to do with this idea of metacognition. Okay, now metacognition is simply awareness of one's own learning. That's what metacognition means. Strategies that help students to be more aware of how they are learning, what they are doing when they are learning well, where they are failing to comprehend something, what they can do to repair those comprehension failures. These are ways of improving students' literacy. Now, this can be done in an English classroom, and I would argue is in many cases done in English classrooms, but this is very different. A science textbook is quite different than a short essay, or than a memoir, or some other kinds of text that typically gets taught in an English classroom. There needs to be some specific work that happens with science textbooks. Now, so metacognition involves the ability to plan learning approaches based on prior knowledge and present context. How am I going to approach this text? What is my purpose in reading this text? Am I trying to get more information about the methods that someone used, or am I trying to figure out in reading this text whether or not it is consistent with other research and why it may or may not be there? Having a clearly defined purpose, for example, and understanding that purpose affects reading is important. Make and assess predictions throughout the reading and learning process. So good readers often unconsciously make predictions about what they expect from this text and continually check those predictions. I guess I was wrong there. I expected this, but I didn't get it. Now I have a new prediction based on this new evidence. And this is a way of checking and keeping my own learning anchored rather than sort of becoming adrift in a sort of sea of words. To identify and implement measures to repair cognitive failures, I mentioned that. To compare, reflect upon, and come to preliminary conclusions about new information and its relationship to prior knowledge. And this is, again, another idea that is important and often overlooked, and that is for successful readers, people who have intuited this kind of work without instruction, we do it without realizing. I come to this not a blank slate, but as someone who has prior knowledge, who knows something about something that relates in some way. It may not be directly related, it may be tangentially related, but making those connections between what I know and what I am learning not only helps me understand concepts by way of, say, analogy, but it also helps solidify that knowledge in my head because it starts to build a web of information that's connected to other information in my mind and therefore has more staying power. Some strategies, just to give you a sense of what this looks like or might look like in a classroom, a few examples of strategies for doing this. One would be metacognitive read alouds. This is where an instructor actually would read aloud from the text. Not just reading the content, but along the way, voicing the mental process that he or she is going through as a reader. This starts to key students into what kinds of questions matter in this discipline as opposed to that discipline. What kinds of questions should I be asking myself? Where might I be asking those questions? What kinds of connections might I make, and where do I make connections between my prior knowledge and a text? An instructor can be doing this kind of work out loud, modeling an approach to reading that helps students become better readers of science texts. Because those questions, those connections are different in science than they are in history, than they are in literature. Reading reflection questions, and I have reflection in very small but capital letters for you. Because I want to make a clear distinction here between reading reflection and reading comprehension questions. Reading comprehension questions we're familiar with. They're in the back of every chapter of every textbook you ever read. They say, what is the answer to the problem X? And your job is to go into the book and figure out where they talk about that and then give it. A reading reflection question asks students to consider their own reading experience, their own learning experience in relation to that text. Where did I encounter information that didn't make sense to me? What did I do in that moment? Are there any other strategies I'm aware of that might have worked in that moment? Right? It's beginning to it's giving students the opportunity to become more self-aware as learners and to be more aware of what strategies and tools are available to them as they read. And then finally, guided activation of prior knowledge. Again, we can say, as readers, we know we have prior knowledge, but understanding ahead of time what knowledge might be relevant is very difficult if we're not practiced at that. And that's where an instructor comes in and guides students into a conversation about, you know, relevant existing knowledge that a student or group of students might be likely to have ahead of time, so that as they read that text, they've got this kind of information at the front of their mind to begin to make these kind of connections. Okay. So, 10 years of research, a little bit more than 10 years of research. Some of these studies, small, some of them actually quite large. In England, there was one study where 76 different schools participated in a pilot program, which involved an emphasis on literacy work for an entire year of the science curriculum. And across the board, it was consistently positive results. Students are not only performing better on standardized science tests after this kind of work, but they are, not surprisingly, also performing better on standardized reading literacy assessments. There's a kind of cross-pollination there that really works in both directions. And yet, there is no systematic implementation of this kind of work in the U.S., this is not because we are idiots or because we don't read literature or because we don't care. It's because we have, I think, a culture of education in the U.S. that is a rich culture, but that in some ways butts heads with some of the things that are required of this kind of approach. And that's what I really want to look at for the next section. Okay, so we have a problem of individual responsibility. A science instructor is not trained to teach reading. Some science instructors in here were probably already saying to themselves, well, I don't know anything about teaching reading. How am I supposed to do this in the classroom? And that's a real problem, right? And English instructors typically don't know science well enough to look at a science textbook and deal with the kind of strategy work that's required in a science textbook. We have that kind of culture of specialization that makes this conversation difficult. And also, even if we were to say, if a science instructor was to say, okay, this seems like it makes sense, I'm willing to look into it, science arguably is the most demanding of instructors field for instructors in terms of professional development. Science is a fast-changing field that requires instructors to keep up with a lot of new and changing information at all times. And then we would be asking them to take on a whole new area of expertise, to become not only expert in science, but to gain at least a certain level of expertise in reading and reading instruction, and then to go back and redesign all of their curriculum in response to this new information. And this is quite a hefty demand to make of our science instructors. And, of course, we have a rich culture in this country, and I really do mean a rich culture, of instructors having the right to choose their own teaching strategies. And there's a great value to that. There's value in that we have teachers who are able to design curriculum in ways that are consistent with their personality, so that there's more effective presentation. I believe it also helps teachers to feel invested in their own work in that classroom. There's an element in which what I'm doing in that classroom is a direct reflection of my own personal interests and my own personal perspectives, and that's a way of keeping me invested and motivated as a teacher. On the other hand, there are those who do argue that this is fundamentally not a science or English issue, not a discipline issue. It's a teaching issue. That if we find something that helps us teach students better, it is our responsibility as teachers, not science teachers or English teachers, to figure out a way to do it. Again, others would say we should sacrifice some of our personal preferences for what we could call student good. And then finally, a lot of people would say we have a responsibility to keep abreast and to implement proven best practices. Right? And that's a key word gets thrown around a lot in education, best practices. And it raises I think, a very important, another vexing question or problem, and that is the problem of professional development. When I say best practices, I hear some chuckling in the room. Because some of you have been to a seminar that was based on best practices, and you thought, what on earth is happening that this is, who decided this, of all things, was the best we could do? So let's look at professional development. All right. So here's our current model. And when I say our, I'm really speaking most specifically about the community college system. I may speak a little bit here and there to some of the differences at different educational levels. Currently, what we offer is offered in seminar formats. That's typically the format, which means in an hour and a half or a three-hour format, you are given some insight into some new practice or into some way of designing curriculum or of teaching, and then you are done. There's no, you know, there's no requirement that you implement this or that you follow up, or even if you are interested in following up, there often isn't the space within the professional development system for that follow-up work. It is designed as a seminar. It's offered potluck style, and I don't mean to belittle, but it's descriptive. Where the focus is determined by each presenter, right? It's often done on a volunteer basis, and it's done where one instructor says, "Well, I've been doing this, and I can give a presentation on that." And another person says, "Well, I've been doing this, and I can give a presentation on that." And so there isn't necessarily a coordinated effort across an entire department or across a campus or a district, et cetera. And that means also that faculty are not required to take, for example, I'm an English instructor. I could do all of my professional development hours in from scientists or from physical education specialists or from people in the music department. There's no requirement that I do discipline specific professional development. And I am hesitant to say that is a problem entirely, because I do interdisciplinary work. I love hearing about what's happening. The only reason I'm standing in front of you as an English instructor is that there is space for interdisciplinary learning. But it does create problems of depth in, the potential for problems for depth in discipline-specific learning. It also demands very little in terms of demonstrated implementation or quality assurance. My understanding of the best practice you just presented to me may be quite different than the reality of that practice. And after 3 hours, I may not necessarily be qualified to be an expert implementer of that process. And there is no follow-up necessarily to make sure that that process, that assignment I created, or that sequence of assignments I created, has the kind of quality or is truly in the spirit of what was just presented. So what we would need, I think, in order to do this kind of work is a commitment to sustained development, multiple meetings, curriculum development, vertical alignment. And by that, I mean if we're going to have intro chemistry, intermediate chemistry, advanced chemistry, we don't want to be repeating the same set of reading strategies. We want to be developing and progressing. And then assessment of the effectiveness of the practices. In order to do that, we would need to coordinate professional development at an institutional and or state level rather than at that local level. And again, this tends to raise the hackles of many instructors because there is a certain degree of suspicion about professional development that comes not from grassroots, not from local need, not from teachers on the ground who know what it looks like on their campus in their department, but from a state official who's checking off a box on a to-do list. So there is some suspicion there, and there is also potential for this to be done well and potential for this to go awry. And then I think And this is perhaps the most controversial and maybe not true as a need, but a requirement that faculty attend and implement. Again, right now you can't require faculty to attend this or that. It's not legally possible. But I think we run into a lot of trouble when we have one faculty member doing this kind of work and another not doing this kind of work. In order for this to be effective, I think there needs to be more substantial implementation across entire departments, campuses, states, etc. All right. So what I hope is that I have given you an overview of some of the obstacles, and I also hope that it's not entirely clear what the best course is, because if that's the way you feel, then I think you have an accurate picture of where we're at. But I think maybe, hopefully, we can answer this question, as sort of the fundamental question of ethics, by asking a few key questions. We can begin to formulate some answers, and those questions are here. What is the right balance between coordinated implementation of best practices and respect for academic freedom? I think there's a fundamental question we need to ask ourselves and answer when it comes to implementing this kind of work. With whom does the primary responsibility for science literacy rest? Is it with the science instructor? Is it with the English instructor? Is it not with educators at all? Is it with scientists or science journalists? These are questions that I think we need to ask. How do we maximize the value of specialization? We have deep knowledge, innovation. These are tremendously important values to specialization, while minimizing the danger. And I think, you know, in education, the danger is both lateral and vertical communication breakdown. We have trouble. The English instructor has trouble communicating with the science instructor, but the science instructor also has trouble communicating with the science student and the English instructor with the student, right? We have these kinds of breakdowns. And in the spirit of very frustrating and impossible questions from your past, if two trains are traveling in opposite directions, one at an average speed of 20 miles an hour for 7 hours, you can fill in the rest. That's really all I have for you tonight.
Tate and I thought it would be a little fun, as you're making your way to the microphones, to show you kind of how science has changed over the years. So this is a biology textbook that might have been used in the 1950s. And so you can see the size of it. You can see kind of the text, the scope. And you have to just indulge me, because I'm using this next textbook only for size. This is a modern college biology size textbook now. So it's my office is moving at the moment, so I couldn't find my actual Neil Campbell biology textbook. But I'll guarantee you it is this size. It is this weight. It's tough to hold up. It is this dimensions, and it's about this wide. So science literacy is a daunting task. It has gotten more so as science has increased in volume, in depth, in complexity, in language. And you can open up to any particular page, and the pictures don't really help. They make it harder. So, you know, it's science literacy is not a small issue. And so we just thought this would be kind of a real visual for you to understand the complexity of the problem. For English teachers to learn the depth of that, and for science teachers to teach people how to navigate that complex work. So with that, let's go to the first question.
Hi, I'm Catherine Parker. I'm actually a chemistry instructor at Grossmont College. And, firstly, thank you. I appreciate your talk very much. So your premise is that the problem is not science literacy, which is not, you say, a content problem, but a literacy issue, and you talk about reading comprehension and understanding. And having taught for the first time after 25 years, I can certainly agree my students can't even write a complete sentence. But I would argue that it's deeper than that. It's not really just understanding how to read and how to comprehend. But really, science literacy is about critical thinking skills and reasoning. And I would argue that part of the problem is that we still have this really old-style lecture format, which we know is totally ineffective. and that students learn by doing and by reasoning and by questioning, and we don't have a format for that. So I was hoping you could mention that a little bit.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And I think that the idea of metacognition and of becoming aware of reading strategies is at its core a way of teaching critical thinking. We talk about critical thinking and the need for critical thinking, but we don't necessarily always have, as you say, strategies for teaching how to think critically. And critical thinking at its core, at least this is what cognitive theory is getting at, getting to more and more, is that it is based in self-awareness. It's about awareness of one's own strategies and learning and the ability to marshal a range of strategies appropriately, at appropriate times, in appropriate ways, given different specific disciplinary needs or contextual needs if it's outside of academic context. And so this is a way, it's an attempt to teach critical thinking strategies rather than simply say, please think critically about this.
Hi, I'm Kim Carpenter, and I teach middle school science in Southeast San Diego. And I was struck by a couple of things, one of which is that if we wait to teach science literacy until college, we've waited too late. And interestingly enough, that this should be the discussion today, is that I spent a large hunk of this afternoon in teachers' meetings, lunch with some colleagues, and then in the science department meeting, and we spent an awful lot of time talking about the fact that at the elementary school level, they assume middle school will teach study skills, and at the middle school level, we assume they've already learned it at the elementary level, and so that the children never learn how to study something, which is perhaps not quite the same as how to read a textbook. But it's certainly related, and that we're going to have to look, if we're going to really solve this problem, I think, at how are we going to teach study skills and how are we going to do it much younger than we are now? Because everybody I was sitting at the table with, and they're all younger than I am, said that they did not learn how to study till they went to college. And that's simply too late. We're going to have to get real. And that means we're going to have to find a way to fit it into a curriculum which is already crammed by the fact that in order to pass tests, we're making kids take 2 hours of math and 3 hours of reading a day. And in a six-hour school day, that doesn't leave a whole lot of time for science or history or, in fact, study skills.
I think it would certainly be easier for us to teach college students if they were not coming to us at sixth and eighth grade teaching reading levels. So I think what you're feeling is absolutely across the board. If only this, then we could do that. And so I think your point is excellent that we have to start a lot earlier with teaching students how to think, how to read, how to take notes, how to study, how to read a textbook. It's a very complicated problem, for sure.
And I would say just my own philosophy as a teacher at a community college would be to just amend that statement just a little bit, but in a meaningful way, I think. And that is starting to teach it at the community college or at the college level is much, much too late. It's much, much later than it should be, but it is never too late. That if it's not, if I have students who haven't learned these strategies at 18 or 25 or 37, then they need to learn them now.
Absolutely.
And they need to learn as much of them as they still can.
Yes.
But I agree that this work needs to happen. And the encouraging thing is that the research that's been done has not been done primarily at the college level. There have been some college level studies, but the research has on these kinds of strategies starts as early as preschool and shows positive results and moves through grade school into middle school, high school. It's been this kind of work, and the studies on its effectiveness have been done at every level of education, and it's consistently positive results. And so people are thinking about this strategy and its implementation earlier.
I'd be interested, the other follow-up question is, how are they applying this to kids who are kinesthetic or visual learners? Because you talk about teaching metacognition about reading it out loud. But at this point, I can tell you that well over 50% of my students are visual learners or kinesthetic learners.
Right, and I think that, so for example, for that visual learner, the reflection questions where that student engages visually with that text and then takes the time to write out responses and reflections on his or her own thinking speaks to that. And that's something that teachers always need to be attentive to, no matter what kind of philosophy they're engaged in, is speaking to the multiple learning styles of students.
And I think that in science, you know, obviously there are lots of pictures in textbooks for good reasons, lots of graphs and charts and pictures to help students navigate their way. And also, there are frequently labs that are hands-on activities that are either incorporated into the lecture or that are taught aside from the lecture, in addition to the lecture, that help take care of those different learning styles as well. And I think it does take a variety of approaches to, I think, really address the learning. I wanted to just hit on the two things that tie together, the two questions that have been asked. You know, scientists in a classroom that have a lot of content to cover, you don't get to critical thinking just by lecture, correct? But in order to do the activities that you have to do to develop critical thinking, you have to give up some content. And so there's always that push-pull in a teaching scientist's mind of how much can I give up to allow the students to critically think and to experiment, and what am I willing to give up? And then think about how most of us learned. When we were being taught, when most scientists were being taught, we didn't have anything but lecture. So the professional development of us as teachers is even more crucial because we didn't have the role models that we now know are so important in developing critical thinking skills and helping students really access the information. Yes, ma'am.
Who then are the underserved populations? Certainly the students, but then doesn't it extend out to all of us? I mean, we all become an illiterate society, or are becoming.
I thought about the answer to that question when I put it in my title. And I mean, I think you're right. On a certain level, if you have been through an educational system that has not actually taught you how to think critically, has just asked you to, but not taught you how to, you have been underserved. But I will also say that part of what the research in metacognitive strategies shows is that those students traditionally most at risk and weakest in science performance, typically African American and Hispanic on government boxes, benefit the most from this kind of strategy. And I think that makes sense. Those with the deepest deficiencies see the biggest gain from including these kinds of skill sets. And so in that sense, it's a strategy that is well-suited to traditionally, historically underserved populations as well.
Thank you. I think the nut that we're all addressing is teaching how to learn rather than what to learn. But I'm wondering if you can talk about more about how to actually implement this change, especially from a political standpoint, because already teachers want to teach how to learn, but the huge political pressure of No Child Left Behind, for example, is already straining them to the limit. Now, at the private higher institutional level, a college, private college, you can certainly, from the highest level, say this is what we're going to do. But from a public college, again, you're constrained. And then there's political pressures in certain states of the union where they require teaching creationism alongside evolution. So that is a content issue, and if we can teach how to learn, maybe that could be addressed. But it seems to me the political issue is what's constraining this whole advancement. Could you comment?
It's a tough nut to crack, really. I think that there are so many different factors involved in that. There are federal, historically, there's a lot of things that fall through the gaps when we run education from the federal level. which is sort of, you know, this sort of telescopic view of my school or your school, which misses some of the nuance of various populations and communities. But there's also teachers' unions who have who fiercely protect academic freedoms for very good and important and productive reasons, but that also in some ways end up creating roadblocks to this kind of implementation. It comes from so many different directions for so many reasons, some of them valuable reasons, that it is, I agree, a tough situation. I can say that at Grossmont, we're currently working on restructuring the way we do professional development as an attempt to address some of these things, and we're moving to having an actual a coordinator, but it's a faculty member. So to sort of have the idea that it's a member of the faculty, focused solely on the question of thinking about professional development, what might be appropriate for faculty on our campus, coordinating that effort a bit more than it has been coordinated administratively. But not mandatory. The issue of making it mandatory that the science instructors would have to do this or that is just not in the cards, and that's part of that political push and pull.
You know, if I might add, there is a really great opportunity in this state. I think the work that's being done by the high schools, the public schools, on core curriculum, and you might roll your eyes and say that's a federally mandated thing, and you know we're concerned about lots of different aspects of it. But there are some real opportunities to work on that core curriculum alignment with community colleges, with universities. And the community colleges are also at really a turning point where we're looking to partner more strategically with our feeder high schools to align curriculum and to make sure that our efforts at educating are as seamless and effective as possible as students navigate this system of high school to college transition. So I think there's great opportunity there for good conversations. They sometimes have to be forced because we're all so busy in our own worlds with our own deadlines and our own mandates that without that effort to say we've got to hook hands and work together, it doesn't happen naturally. And so I think there really is a great opportunity right now from both the community college aspect or university aspect as well as the high school aspect, and it's not to be wasted because these opportunities don't come along very often.
Hi, I'm Pat Bryan. I'm refreshed by the ideas that you're coming up with. I've been retired now for a long time, but I did teach for 2 decades in the community college system, Riverside Community College, our largest one in California, and also taught at San Diego State. And just a couple of reflections, because my questions are already been addressed. But one was that some of us that were scientists that came into education by the back door and didn't know we were going to get hooked, we were not taught how to educate. We were scientists. We had degrees, and therefore we could teach just by forfeit. Yeah. And I had the pleasure, in retrospect, of teaching at night. And then when I was pregnant, I had the pleasure of being a substitute teacher. And I found an interesting gap there that from kindergarten to third grade, the students wanted to learn. And then my students that were in community college at night, and at San Diego State at night, even if they didn't want to learn, their time was valuable because they had worked all day. And they had this desire, which caused a responsibility on the part of myself to deliver to them something that perhaps during the day, when a lot of California students are there because, well, I graduated, I don't know what to do, I'm going to college, you know, that attitude. And it allowed me to change my way of teaching from primarily lecture, professing, because I had such knowledge, they had to just listen to me and osmosis it in, to causing more interaction between the students. And I think that was helpful. So I wanted to get your input into how do we increase the willingness of scientists to get hooked and to get enthusiastic about teaching with either kindergarten through third grade, because after that they say, well, is this going to be on a test? Do I need to regurgitate this, i.e., you know? And to get this enthusiasm back into teaching, if it was ever there, but I remember my teachers were enthusiastic about teaching. And how do we help scientists to bridge this gap between being scientific and being educators?
I'm tempted to pass this to you as a former scientist and now educator.
Well, you know, it's funny, I always smiling to myself because you described my life perfectly. You know, I was a scientist, I was trained as a biologist, I went to get my PhD in biochemistry. I felt like I wanted to teach. I always knew that I wanted to teach. And when I went to graduate school, people looked at me like I was crazy because it was not the kind of profession that you would actually admit out loud to people that you wanted to do. You did teaching as a scientist because it enabled you to have a lab and have graduate students and get grants. And to say that you wanted to teach, heaven forbid, in high school or in college to undergraduates, meant that you somehow couldn't cut it as a scientist. So it was like this, you know, life that you lived, you secretly said, this is my desire and this would make me happy, but you walked the walk that everybody sort of expected you to walk. When I got my first teaching job at a community college, mind you, I was working in the world's premier cancer research center in Houston, Texas, MD Anderson Cancer Center. When I told my boss I was going to take a teaching job at a community college, I started getting cards and letters from people saying, I'm so sorry you're leaving science. And to me, it was a way to transfer that enthusiasm and energy to the next generation of people. But it was a very hard turn to make. And I don't think it's an easy turn to make. You're like a salmon swimming upstream. I think that we have to value the profession of teaching as a whole in our society. We have to value it very differently because these are the people that make the next generation what they are. We don't value that profession. We don't pay them adequately. We don't support them adequately. We don't provide the resources that they need. The more we cut schools, the more you see teachers cleaning desks and dumping trash because there isn't enough support for them. So I think there's some really fundamental pieces about what we think of teachers and professors and instructors that has to change. They're as important as any other profession and maybe more so, because the impact that they leave on a generation is as important as parents sometimes. I mean, you think back about your favorite teacher in high school. I'd ask each of you to do that. Think back about your favorite teacher and think about what it was that made that person so special in your life. It probably wasn't the content. It wasn't the textbook. It wasn't the schoolroom, it wasn't the principal, it wasn't the dean, it wasn't anybody in the department chair. It was that person. The fact that they cared about you, the fact that they invested in you. And that, I agree with you, that's the energy and the commitment that we need to incentivize in our teachers all along the way. Whether it's a K through third grade teacher or whether it's a middle school teacher or high school teacher or a college professor. And I think the problem is really fundamentally what as society do we think is important in that individual, and how do we value that in a way that it makes it the rewarding profession that it really is. I don't know if that answered your question, but you really hit at the core of my life, so I wanted to share that with you.
Maybe thank you. As you were talking, maybe I was thinking I could add one thing, and that is, you know, we're seeing not only that we have a generation or generations of citizens ill-equipped to deal with scientific information, but we also have a real shortage of trained scientists for the fields we have. And I think that our education system is producing both problems. And the more we can get the scientific community to recognize that the science problem is an education problem and that intervention at the educational level is a fix for the science problem, we may have a stronger commitment there.
Thank you. It's a great question. Okay.
I want to close this evening's program with a brief observation about what I think we've heard, and that's that the society we live in is made up. Vast majority of people don't know the content. They can't read to learn the content. They don't understand science or how science works. And that's an overwhelming or a majority of the people in our society. Of course, that's none of the people in this room because we are all science literate in here. But I think all of us have learned tonight science literacy is about much more. And we've also learned that the problem is terribly complex in terms of political issues, financial support issues. But one aspect that I think has been brought up is the need to engage people, as Tate mentioned, in this idea of ethics as a way to engage people that might not otherwise be interested in science is an important one. And this is segueing into a plug for not the next program, but the program in March for this Exploring Ethics series. The speaker will be talking about engaging people through science interestedness to try and bring people to science because it's important and because it's an important part of our lives. So I want to encourage all of you to join us for that program, as well as next month's program, all of these the first Wednesday of the month, when we'll be talking about really science from the perspective of scientists and what we as scientists or what society looking at science can trust and can't trust, and the ways in which science might inadvertently or sometimes intentionally be misused. All of these issues come directly from the story of Henrietta Lacks, which is why it's been such a rich topic for this year. I want to thank all of you for a fascinating discussion tonight. I particularly want to thank both Tate and Sunita for a wonderful leading of tonight's discussion.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.